It's Friday, September 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, China's activity in the South China Sea remains a concern.
This time, Putin is trying to move his strategic direction from Europe to Asia, Russia's version of pivoting to Asia.
The focus on Asia is increasing amid renewed U.S. commitment to the region. Also ahead, the U.S. presidential candidates appear on the same interview program and an art exhibit painting images of a tragic day. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. President Obama placed maritime tensions in the South China Sea front and center during some of his final remarks at an Asian summit in Laos.
We'll continue to work to ensure that disputes are resolved peacefully, including in the South China Sea. The landmark arbitration ruling in July, which is binding, helped clarify maritime rights in the region. I recognize this raises tensions, but I also look forward to discussing how we can constructively move forward together to lower tensions and promote diplomacy and regional stability.
Mr. Obama referenced a ruling by the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague July 12th that ruled China's claims to most of the vital waterway had no legal basis and its construction of artificial islands was illegal. China has vowed to ignore the ruling. On Wednesday, the Philippines, which brought the case to the court in 2013, produced photos alleging fresh Chinese construction activity at Scarborough Shoal, about 230 kilometers from Manila's main island, which Beijing seized in 2012. China on Wednesday insisted there is no change in activity. University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer tells VOA's Victor Beatty the United States detected increased surveying activity in March and April of this year, took certain steps, and China seemed to back down.
This recent activity seems to indicate that the number of Coast Guard vessels has increased and that there are civilian ships that look like a dredger and others carrying supplies and others that could be carrying work crews. What we don't know is the intent, but definitely those ships loitering around Scarborough Shoal at the time of the recent summits and after the arbitration seems to be a worrying development.
The ASEAN countries meeting in Laos issued a very tepid statement, if you will. We remain seriously concerned over recent ongoing developments. They didn't even mention China.
Since 1992, when ASEAN first issued its statement, when China and Vietnam were engaging in some confrontation over oil exploration, till the present, ASEAN has never mentioned China by name. The expressions of serious concern first surfaced by memory 2014-15 when China began constructing these artificial islands. ASEAN could agree back then on that statement, and they can't really advance it, so they're still expressing serious concern.
Are these images produced by the Philippines public knowledge now? Have you had a chance to look at them and tell me what you thought?
The Philippines Air Force has been very, very good with aerial photographs for a very long period of time, and particularly the photo interpretation that comes with them. So I would accept that they're true. They also were based on reports of sightings by Filipino fishermen who were up much closer. So I don't think there's a problem there. The Philippines routinely does that, and they're routinely challenged by China. If it's up to six Coast Guard vessels, that's not a particular problem. That's just status quo. But if more surveying ships come down, as had begun assembling in March of this year, then it would be a worrying development. And the point about Scarborough Shoal is that if China were to build on it, it would complete a radar net that would give China total domain awareness throughout the entire South China Sea, and then more particularly be very close to Subic Bay, which is a vital military port, and therefore able to better access information about the comings and goings of a rotational presence of American forces on the five bases in the Philippines.
Carl Thayer says he doubts China would engage in such provocative behavior as construction around the shoal, in part because the new Philippines government of President Rodrigo Duterte has no clear policy yet on maritime disputes. Meanwhile, the state-run Global Times said it was wise for members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to leave out of their final communique any mention of the arbitration ruling. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang, who met with ASEAN leaders in Laos, has called for closer coordination to lower tensions. Well, it's time now for our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me right here in the studio with what's trending online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Star Trek is dominating the social media scene Thursday, and the trending hashtag is #StarTrek50, which means it's been 50 years since the series started. I am not a huge Star Trek fan. I hate to say because I'm probably going to lose 50 followers on Twitter, but I couldn't help notice it on Twitter and Facebook.
Well, Star Trek is a little bit generational, too. I mean, for those of us who started out with it 50 years ago and others that have come along, what are people saying about it?
Well, let's start with what NASA tweeted. In celebration of #StarTrek50, our administrator on the real-world impact of fictional characters Uhura and Sulu. That got more than 4,000 likes within 6 to 7 hours. The tweet includes a short clip featuring the two ethnic minority actors who played Uhura and Sulu in the popular series. American business magazine Forbes also shared a cartoon that depicted things from the series that have come true. Very cool. They include handheld communication, universal translator, tablets, and wireless earpiece.
Right, and also the 62-year-old Trekkie that they show there.
That's so true.
As well. Well, you know, William Shatner, who played Captain Kirk.
You mentioned him before the show.
In his 80s now, yes. Well, Star Trek has its own Twitter account too, correct?
That's correct. And surprise, surprise, it's at Star Trek. It tweeted, "It all started 50 years ago today. #StarTrek50.
Well, gee, speaking of handheld communication and wireless earpieces, any buzz on Apple?
There is. Reuters tweeted, "Update, Apple has lost more than $15 billion in market value since Wednesday's close." Mm. As you know, the company revealed its iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus yesterday.
Wow, and that's because of its stock prices reacting.
That's correct.
Many people really didn't like the wireless earphones. Anything else before you go?
Well, if you ever plan on visiting the Hermit Kingdom, also known as North Korea, you better leave sarcasm behind. Media outlets are tweeting that the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, banned the use of sarcasm in his country. Here's an example from The Telegraph. Kim Jong-un bans sarcasm in North Korea, fearing people will only agree with him, ironically. Yep, that's going to work. Oops. That's all for me today. Jim?
Well, assuming he can understand the language the sarcasm is spoken in. Thanks for that wrap-up, G. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. You'll find G and myself out there as well at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, the United States and China tensions undermine cooperation on North Korean nuclear threat. Indian man sentenced to death for killing woman with acid. Kofi Annan says Myanmar Rohingya panel will not police human rights. Chinese imports rise for the first time in almost 2 years. And a story you'll definitely want to check out on our website, Everyone's a Frenemy in Asia's Big Game. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and also via our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The United States is not the only country that is pivoting to Southeast Asia and trying to build influence in the region. Japan and Russia are also stepping up efforts to forge trade, diplomatic, and military ties there as well. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
China has long been Southeast Asia's biggest trade partner, but other countries are catching up. Over the past 3 years, Japan has put more investment into ASEAN than in China and Hong Kong. Regional analyst Tidley Basu says the U.S. pivot and China's rise are key drivers of that shift.
The arrival of China as a major power has made Japan really impatient to redefine its role in the Asia-Pacific security order.
Japan's focus is not only on building business, but security and diplomatic ties as well. And as more nations compete for influence, that inevitably is creating tensions. Security analyst Richard Bitzinger says conflicting and cross-cutting purposes is really what defines Asia these days.
Everybody's a frenemy, so to speak. And so there's a lot of places where two countries, Russia, China, the United States, find lots of opportunities and common interests that make them want to cooperate. At the same time, there's a lot of places where they collide and they compete.
More of a late comer to the big game in Asia, Russia is also stepping up its own efforts with arms sales to Vietnam and energy deals. Political scientist Roger Jung.
For the past few years, Russia has been preoccupied with events in Europe. So this time, Putin is trying to move his strategic direction from Europe to Asia, Russia's version of pivoting to Asia as a balancer to rising U.S. influence in the region.
But while leaders in Asia are committed to keeping tensions from exploding, Bitzinger says the potential for inadvertent conflict is a growing concern. A
lot more types of very sophisticated weapons are flowing into the region. Coupled with that, the fact you're seeing an increasingly kind of intransigent amount of brinksmanship that's going on, I think, in the South China Sea in particular.
And with that brinksmanship and an increasingly complex patchwork of ties, analysts say smaller and minor incidents have a bigger chance of spinning out of control. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
A lot more activity now in the race for the White House as Election Day draws ever closer. All the way from Laos, U.S. President Barack Obama denounced Donald Trump as unfit to be the American commander-in-chief after the Republican presidential candidate said Russian President Vladimir Putin has been more of a leader than Obama. Quote, "I don't think the guy's qualified to be president of the United States, and every time he speaks, that opinion is confirmed," Mr. Obama said, in what was an unusually caustic comment about the U.S. presidential contest, this while he was traveling overseas. During an NBC News forum on Wednesday, in which Trump was interviewed separately from Clinton, Trump said he thinks if he's elected and succeeds Obama as president, he would have a very good relation with the Russian president. He said Russia and the United States have a joint interest in defeating Islamic State jihadists. As a major party candidate, Trump has received confidential intelligence briefings meant to ensure that the next leader is knowledgeable about U.S. foreign policies when their term begins. When asked if he was shocked by anything he had heard, Trump said Obama, Clinton, and Secretary of State John Kerry did the opposite of what intelligence experts told them. Trump said he was qualified to be commander-in-chief because, quote, "I built a great company, I've been all over the world, I've dealt with foreign countries, I have great judgment, I know what's going on." Trump also said he was totally against the war in Iraq, a claim that is contradicted by his initial support for the 2003 U.S. invasion.
"I think the main thing is I have great judgment. I have good judgment. I know what's going on. I've called so many of the shots. And I happened to hear Hillary Clinton say that I was not against the war in Iraq. I was totally against the war in Iraq. You can look at Esquire magazine from 2004. You can look at before that. And I was against the war in Iraq because I said it's going to totally destabilize the Middle East, which it has. It has absolutely been a disastrous war. And by the way, perhaps almost as bad was the way Barack Obama got out. That was a disaster."
Mrs. Clinton said that her vote for the Iraq war when she was a U.S. senator was a mistake, but that it was important to learn from mistakes. She also pushed back against Trump's repeated assertions during the campaign that he opposed the U.S. attack on Iraq. Clinton said the most important quality in a president is steadiness and the strength to make hard decisions.
"I've had the unique experience of watching and working with several presidents. And these are not easy decisions. If they were, they wouldn't get to the president in the first place. And when you're sitting in the Situation Room, as I have on numerous occasions, particularly with respect to determining whether to recommend the raid against bin Laden, what you want in a president, a commander-in-chief, is someone who listens, who evaluates what is being told to him or her, who is able to sort out the very difficult options being presented."
"You're talking about
and then
judgment.
Makes the decision. That's right."
Clinton has faced criticism and investigations for her use of an unsecured private email server while serving as the country's top diplomat during Obama's first term from 2009 to 2013. Investigators said she was extremely careless, but criminal charges were not warranted. Clinton called the fight against Islamic State the top counterterrorism goal, advocating using air power and getting more support from Arabs and Kurds in fighting Islamic State militants, while also supporting the Iraqi military. She said no U.S. ground combat troops would go to Iraq or Syria. Trump and Clinton will be squaring off directly in their first presidential debate. That's scheduled for September 26th, with two more scheduled in October in the weeks before the November 8th general election. You can visit voanews.com for much more on all of the latest developments as the election campaigns continue. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. An art exhibit opens Monday in New York. This one showcases works about the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington and is displayed at the National September 11th Memorial and Museum at Ground Zero in New York City. Alice Greenwald is the museum's director and describes the exhibit to International Edition host Sarah Williams.
In anticipating the 15th anniversary of the attacks, so many of us were thinking about the kind of distinction between then and now, you know, where we were then, where we are now. And we just thought it would be so interesting to think back to where we were then, but through the lens of art. All of us reacted on that day, profound shock, profound grief, disbelief, all of those feelings mixed together, and fear, all of it. And, you know, time passes and those feelings are not quite as vivid, but we remember where we were, we remember the moment so clearly. And there is something about art that connects with an immediacy that really nothing else does. And artists, like everyone, responded on 9/11. They had those feelings, they had those reactions, but because they are artists, they turn to their practice, to their craft, to try to make sense of what they saw with their eyes but could not believe they were seeing, and tried to come to terms with it in ways that now communicate so powerfully and emotionally and vividly to all of us.
Now, how did you select the artists and the works of art to be contained in this exhibit?
Well, you know, like any exhibition, it was a process, and we never intended, we didn't start out thinking this was going to be a kind of survey of 9/11 response art or anything like that. We were looking at works, we sort of set a few different kinds of criteria for us. We were looking for established artists, people who already had an artistic practice of one kind or another, because we really did want to see how artists used their work and their methodology and their craft, their forms of expression, to make sense of something all of us were struggling to make sense of. So that was one thing. We were looking for established artists. We were looking for people, artists who had a direct personal connection to the events on 9/11. And what we meant by that were people who perhaps lost a loved one, a family member or a close friend on 9/11, or artists whose studios were located in the vicinity of the World Trade Center. So, and in some cases, these artists lost their studios. Their studios were destroyed or damaged, you know, with the crashing in of debris through their windows, or people who witnessed it literally with their own eyes, you know, were in New York and in Lower Manhattan and ran to their rooftops and watched the events unfold. So we were looking for that kind of direct personal encounter and established artists. And little by little, you know, our curators obviously have been tracking response art, art created in response to 9/11 for some time now, for over a decade. And they went through their, you know, their files and their imagery, and they did their research. And little by little, a show emerged that now includes 13 artists in various media. I mean, we have paintings, we have works on paper, we have multimedia, we have sculpture. And each of them in their own right is unique and compelling and insightful and emotional. But there is something about these works that they seem to converse with one another. And part of what happened in the curatorial journey that we were on is that we began to see commonalities among some of these works and some of these artists. For example, there was a preoccupation among many of them with the blue sky that day, or the sky itself, and how the sky changed. You know, there was that, what they call the severe clear blue of 9/11. It was so clear that day and so vividly blue. And some of the artists referenced that.
Alice Greenwald, the director of the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. Be sure to tune in to this very program on Monday for much more on the 15th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at voanews.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well. Always great to have two seasoned veterans paired in our studio, director Tracy Carter and engineer Dave Magnus. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, and on this 50th anniversary of Star Trek, live long and prosper.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Authorities in Venezuela have again imprisoned opposition leader Daniel Ceballos. Mr. Ceballos, the former mayor of the western city of San Cristobal, had been released from prison last year and placed under house arrest for health reasons. He was arrested in March 2014 for allegedly inciting violence during protests against food shortages, high inflation, and rampant crime. Mr. Ceballos carried out a hunger strike in May and June of 2015 to demand that the government release political prisoners and set a date for legislative elections. On June 3rd of that year, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights publicly requested that the government provide medical attention to and release Daniel Ceballos, as well as political prisoners Leopoldo Lopez, Raul Emilio Baduel, and Alexander Tirado, who were also on a hunger strike. On August 11, 2015, authorities released Ceballos to house arrest. On August 27th, just days before national demonstrations for political and economic reforms were to take place, the Venezuelan government revoked his house arrest and in the middle of the night transferred him to prison. Opposition leaders believe Mr. Ceballos is a political prisoner and his arrest was an effort to quash dissent. In a press statement issued August 28th, John Kirby, U.S. State Department spokesperson, said, "The United States is deeply disturbed by the Venezuelan government's decision to move opposition leader Daniel Ceballos from house arrest to prison. Mr. Ceballos' transfer to prison represents an effort to intimidate and impede the Venezuelan people's right to peacefully express their opinion. We condemn it and call for Mr. Ceballos' immediate release. The basic underpinnings of the rule of law in Venezuela have degraded to an alarming degree. There is no place in a democratic society for employing the instruments of the state to bully, intimidate, and silence the political opposition. The September 1st marches proceeded largely without incident, but Mr. Ceballos and others detained in the days leading up to them remain incarcerated. Further, the government deported or barred entry to at least six international journalists who had planned to cover the demonstrations. On September 3rd, the government detained journalist Braulio Jatar on Isla Margarita after he published news of a local anti-Maduro protest on his Margarita-based website, Reporte Confidencial. The United States is deeply concerned by the detentions and restrictions on press freedom before and after the march and the ongoing serious human rights issues in Venezuela.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.